Today is Saturday, April 13th, 2019. It is 12 p.m., and this is panel number 5301. No. Speak up. Okay. I'll speak up. I'll get closer to the mic. Should I repeat that? Are we good? You got that back there? Okay. Awesome. The panel is entitled Sustainability and Me, Our Role in Saving the Planet. Wow. My name is Matthew Davis. I'm a senior instructor here in environmental design at the University of Colorado Boulder. Let me do some business here. In this CWA session, we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. You must write legibly. If you are a student, please note this on your question. Make your questions brief and to the point. Okay, I'm happy to have a very distinguished panel here with us today. Just move this down a little bit. There we go. First of all, we have Mary Mattingly. Mary is a Brooklyn-based artist whose work explores issues of sustainability, climate change, and displacement, combining photography, performance, portable architecture, and sculptural ecosystems into poetic visions of adaptation and survival, expressing in my mind the horrific impacts we humans have had on this planet. Mary's work has been exhibited at Storm King, one of my favorite places, the International Center of Photography, the Seoul Art Center, Brooklyn Museum, New York Public Library, De Cordova Museum and Sculpture Park, and Palais de Tokyo. In 2017, she founded the Project Swale, a public floating food forest, edible landscape on a barge in New York City, created to circumvent public land laws. More recently, Mary completed polyhuman-assisted sculptural ecosystem for the International Havana Biennial. Next, we have Leslie Price. Keith Sproul. I got the order here on my sheet. Keith is from Jackson, Wyoming, and is dedicated to utilizing tourism as an economic tool for the sustainable development of local and regional economies. He has worked in Asia, Africa, Central Europe, the Middle East, and the Americas. In the course of his career, he has traveled to over 130 countries. As an analyst and tourism development specialist, he has focused in particular on the economics of cultural heritage and nature-based tourism, most often in association with rural communities on the edge of wilderness. Currently serving as the executive director of Abercrombie and Kent Philanthropy, a leading private sector travel philanthropy with the mission to positively impact lives and livelihoods in the communities where A&K guests travel. Sproul manages a portfolio of 42 projects in 21 countries. Leslie Price is communications director at Index, Designed to Improve Life, a nonprofit organization based in Copenhagen, Denmark. Originally from Australia, Leslie oversees all communication efforts at Index. Founded in 2001, Index provides knowledge, global recognition, and capital to people using design to bring about purposeful change. The organization is best known for the Index Award, a large-scale design biennial celebrating the world's most iconic and impactful solutions. Notable past winners include Duolingo, LifeStraw, and the Ocean Cleanup. Leslie is most interested in human-centered design, everything from the very simple to the almost sci-fi. In line with Index, her mission is to show how design can be instrumental in establishing a good quality of life for all. Now, before we begin, I just want to have a little subtext here. Our role in saving the planet. What can average people, those not in positions of power or privilege, do to contribute to the fight against climate change? What is our responsibility? How do we overcome feelings of powerlessness? I would like each panelist to respond, approximately 5 minutes, to give their opening comments, personal stories, anecdotes, however you see fit. Thanks.
Thanks. Can you hear me? Okay. So I think about... Closer? Okay.
Maybe turn it that way a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, so I think about the question a lot, and I wanted to share a personal story. Mm-hmm. So I grew up poor in a rural agricultural town in New England in the 1980s. The insecticide DDT wasn't being used on farms anymore, but it was still in the water table. So when I was young, the state retested the water, and we were told it was contaminated we'd need to buy bottled water. So like many people there, I live with an autoimmune disease that I can't prove is from the water. Mine's a common experience. In my own research 30 years later, I learned that more private systems in the area are contaminated than when I was growing up. Even with the move from well water to public-private infrastructure. So in the year 2000, to jump back, I'd saved enough money to move across the country and enroll in art school. I moved to Portland, Oregon, and water was in the news. Bechtel and the World Bank had privatized water in Bolivia, and the poor couldn't afford the new price. People protested. The police shot and killed protesters. What was later called water wars in Bolivia had triggered my own fight-or-flight response. For me, this wasn't a faraway problem. This was an American company, and the issue of water was close to home. So a year later, I moved to Greenpoint, Brooklyn, the site of one of the largest oil spills in the United States. No one in the neighborhood outwardly seemed to care. I knew New York City's drinking water was some of the best in the country, protected by hundreds of thousands of acres of land that simultaneously deprived communities upstate of using that land to support themselves. It was a trade-off. I was grateful to have access to the clean water. So while I don't think of myself as a selfish person, many rationalizations I make are based on my own health and care. I don't always have time or groceries at home to pack lunch, so I end up buying on the go and tossing the packaging in a garbage can that I know is probably going back to my hometown in a landfill. So my basic needs motivate me. It's what almost all my artwork is about, because it allows me to minimally care for myself and make art at the same time. Often, I don't feel like I have time to read up on the latest carbon sequestration idea, yet more recently I found months of time to dedicate to building an edible landscape on a barge. Maybe it's because that action was not speculative to me, but clear. But it was also so much fun. So it was fun in the way that you get an adrenaline rush when you're skiing down a new slope. I didn't feel angry, but I felt like I was making a difference. I juggle what I'm passionate about, which is art, protecting water and food, and paying my rent. Swale started because I wanted shared access to healthy food, to the waterfront. I believe that the more people who interact with water, the more we care for it, and contemplative space. So 2,000 unpaid labor hours later, and $200,000 in grant money later, could have bought a lot more healthy food than Swale has grown to date. But now New York City is growing edible perennial plants in one park and allowing anyone access to pick 24 hours a day, breaking their own 100-year-old law. And now people talk about public food as a right. So I do things out of habit, out of desire, out of social momentum, out of fight or flight, and ultimately out of what's best for me. I'm also motivated by the ascetic lives of spiritual people, by finding love through repair, maintenance, building soil, and when I see minimalism moving from a contemplative art movement to a lifestyle choice, I want to inquire, what moves an idea or a way of life from the fringes of a culture to the mainstream? Thanks.
The theme is generally broad, which I understand is part of the CWA, and I kind of love that. But I'm going to build on the water, the theme. I understood the purpose of this session today was to try to nurture a sense of hope in the context of sustainability in me, as the title. And so I want to share some of the work that we're doing and hope that it instills a feeling of hope. We're a travel company. Abercrombie & Ken is a luxury travel company. We are known to take people around the world to places where you don't want to drink the water and to do it in a safe and comfortable manner. So spirit of adventure, we're in Africa, Asia, Latin America. There's a commitment, a corporate commitment to giving back to any destination where our guests travel. And so I've got a very wonderful position, the opportunity to invest with communities in education, healthcare, job creation in those communities, and very, very specifically conservation. I have a bias, spent many years in Africa, and those communities that are living on the edge of wilderness in particular need to benefit from the travel industry if we expect them to maintain their commitment to living with human-wildlife conflict, human-elephant conflict, human-predator conflict. The encroachment that takes place inside of parks, I believe, can be directly tied to the fact that they feel no value in travelers coming to those parks. And the industry itself has got to do a lot more to step it up. One of the ways that we do that is water. And I was kind of sharing the story because it actually does connect. I'll let you do the connections, explain the connections. But there's a new technology, a microfiber hollow fill that will filter water. And Life Straw, how many people in the audience have a Life Straw water bottle, water filter? Yeah. They're growing in their popularity, certainly, and they're available at REI. That's at the level of taking out the bacteria, large parasites, amoebas, but they've got larger filters that will also clear 99.99% of viruses from the water, so it hits World Health Organization standards. As a travel company, we've made a commitment to trying to improve the lives and livelihoods in the communities where we carry our guests. I very specifically focus that on communities that live on the edge of wilderness. So we recently partnered with Life Straw and introduced the water filters to every school that borders the Masai Mara. 34 schools, 16,000 children on a daily basis have access to clean water. And there's an ancillary, really important benefit that ties into some of the conference themes, that traditionally there'd be a large metal vat for clean water for boarding school students in particular. And firewood at great expense in an area of deforestation, you burn the wood, you collect the steam over here, and that becomes your drinking water, only for drinking. The benefit of having a filtration system is that young women can put as much water as they'd like through, and they can take it back for personal hygiene. So during menstruation, they can clean themselves and their clothes, and hopefully that's influencing them to stay in school those extra couple days a month. Anything we can do, and I say this from our corporate commitment as well, to keep a young girl in school is a worthwhile investment. So there's a very tangible investment there. From the context of the guest experience, when our guests visit a school, they see the water filters and they see the kids lining up between class having a glass of really clear water, they get it. And so we open the door, if they would like to support, to please join us in this effort. We are, at the end of this month, expanding to every school that borders the Ngorongoro Crater. We're working with the Ngorongoro Crater Conservation Authority, the Maasai that control the crater. And we're introducing the filters to 15 schools, another 7,000 children. And working with Life Straw, we're partnering to create a water station at the entrance so that every guide, driver, ranger, guest can stop and fill their water bottle instead of carrying plastics. So it broaches over to sustainability issues relative to plastics. We're one travel company. Every travel company ought to be able to speak to this type of investment in making a tangible difference and improvement in lives. The greatest joy I have is when I get a call from a mother who talks about their kids having been on vacation and they can't stop talking about it, they want to do something. And so we give them an outlet, and that's, I hope, part of the idea of hope in the context of this conversation. Thank you.
Can everyone hear me up the back there? Yep, great. So we've got some tough acts to follow, but I'm going to keep my introduction short, but it's about something that's very close to me, something I'm very passionate about. So of course, motivation to do something about sustainability is tough for us, and I get it. The media feeds us a lot of problems. They don't give us a lot of solutions, and they don't give us a lot of advice. But I think one place that we can really make an impact is meat production. And I know it's a very touchy subject for some people. But as it stands, we kill 56 billion animals a year for meat. That's not including fish. That's 77% of all global agricultural land. And that's up to 18% of global emissions. And I think that's a huge problem. So we might not have a lot of power, each of us, but we've all got purchasing power. So I think if we can cut back, that would make a huge impact and not only give us a lot more respect for our food. So that's one subject that I'm really passionate about, and I'm looking forward to opening up the discussion with my panelists.
Great, thank you. Is there any response we'd like to make to opening comments? If not, we can move on with some questions. Have the note cards been distributed? Because I have nothing coming up here yet. And I have questions, but I'd like the audience to participate and other people around the world that are observing this this conference. While we're doing that, I did a little research in preparation for this, and I looked at a recent survey done by the Yale Program in Climate Change Communication. And we probably hear these things, and they're probably on the news. Approximately 70% of Americans believe that climate change is happening, but only about 6 in 10, a little over 60%, believe that humans are causing it. So I find that interesting or worrisome when we nearly have a 100% consensus in actual people that are doing the research, climate scientists around the world. Okay, sorry about that. Did anybody hear that? Do I have to do that all over again? Nobody heard anything. Okay. Okay, I
put the microphone, your friend.
Well, I don't want to eat it, but it's okay. We don't know each other that well. Okay. A recent survey done at the Yale Program for Climate Change brought up some interesting facts and figures, and I'll just focus on one. They surveyed, across the country, and what they found is about half of Americans feel hopeful for the future about climate change, and half feel hopeless. Now, we all also mentioned before, which you couldn't hear, that we have 70% of Americans believe that climate change is happening, regardless of the causes, and only 62% believe that it's human-induced. So when we have 100%, nearly 100% of climate scientists confirming this, where is that 40% coming from? Where is this sense of disagreement with the actual facts in this? That's one thing that I would like to point out and maybe get some response. But the question is there a sense of powerlessness, lack of information, or just plain old denial of what's going to happen potentially in the future when we might have 8 years to do something about it? Some people are saying maybe it's game over already. So if anyone wants to respond to that, I can move on to other questions. I have others too.
I mean, I think powerlessness, feeling powerless leads to denial, and I think it's, the last thing that you want to feel is helpless, so denying is a way to not feel as helpless, right? So, yeah, I guess that's how.
I would agree with Mary. I think denial, it's also very easy. I think a lot of the time people say they care, but then they don't do anything about it. I mean, I think as consumer behavior is very hard to change. So I think it's, it's very, very tough. I think, of course, a lot of people can do things and a lot of people can't. And I wouldn't say I'm a pessimist, but I'm a realist, and I think maybe half of the population will change their lifestyle, and the other half won't. And this is also, climate change, it's not something that we can sort of attack, in half measures. So I think what I also think is very much interesting is what kind of design and innovation can we come up with to basically offset that other half of people who can't or probably won't do something.
The travel industry is going crazy on this subject because it's opening and closing doors. The number of cruise ships that are now able to go through the Northwest Passage, the number of ships that are going down to Antarctica, prospects for other openings, the Eastern Passage. It's a commercial venture, and the industry is going to move into opportunity. At the same time, in some of the desert environments, the heat is so extreme that there are shorter seasons. Guests simply can't move comfortably in certain of our desert environments. So it's one that's panning out as a real influence, obviously, It's got crazy aspects. The king crab is an invasive species that's making its way down through the fjords. And now one of the guest experiences is to go on a king crab safari. You know, if you held up a king crab and you looked at it, it looks like an invasive. But it tastes really good. And so people, you know, they go out and they learn about how they're harvesting, but they devastate the sea floor. And they're eating their way down. They think the adaptation rate is, you know, going to allow them to reach France. There's probably invasive species experts in the audience, but that's the industry responding to a mix of opportunity and failing to confront the realities. I think there's a lot of denial in the context of our global industry. Still.
Yeah, I think denial is understandable, especially until it's closer to home. So it's interesting in terms of travel, because then all of the sudden problems that you might not face in your daily life you're faced with, and you bring that home and you're close to people you met there or the sea creatures you met there. Yeah, so I think desire is key. Ways, I think, and this probably comes into play in your work, ways that designers work to channel desire, mm-hmm. and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we talked about, it's easy to remain complacent when you're very much insulated from the direct effects. So, of course, in developed countries like we are here, of course, a lot of people will remain in denial or complacent because it doesn't affect them. So, of course, that's something we need to change.
Great. I have a ton of questions up here. Where to begin? I want to just acknowledge first, we've had four or five that just talk about plant-based diets, and we probably know what the impact that meat and that sort of agriculture has on the planet. I think there's no doubt that we need to move towards different systems of agriculture, first of all. So does anyone want to comment on that? I just wanted to cover that because we've had so many, four or five or six questions about that point.
I think I don't want to be here to lecture people to tell you to stop eating meat. I think that kind of approach, you know, really shaming people, that's never really the case. I think we need to have a discussion about it. But of course, we can definitely see the insane amount of growth with people developing plant-based proteins, and the popularity in that has just skyrocketed, I'm sure, in the States as well, and what we're seeing in Europe. I think it's going to take all kinds of solutions. I think, of course, plant-based proteins, different kinds of agriculture, I don't think we should stop it entirely. I think there's plenty of ways we can still farm, but do it in a sustainable way. And I think cutting back will just make a huge difference. So that's what I would really urge people to do. And as I said earlier, I think it gives us more respect for our food, which I think, you know, we're so far detached from where our food comes from. So I think that also really needs to change, about sort of educating kids and also adults about where our food actually comes from, what resources goes into producing it. And we should be a lot more grateful, I think. Of course, I've talked about this in other panels, but I think is also really exciting is lab-grown meat. I know it scares people, but I think it's, as I said, I'm sure half of the world will remain complacent and probably won't change their lifestyle. So I think that kind of stuff is needed. We can't just expect everyone to change because they won't. I think it's a little bit naive to think that way. Of course, we should always try, but we really will need innovation, I think.
In terms of lifestyle change, I remember being 13 and watching a PETA video and that making me turn vegetarian for about 15 years until I learned I had celiac, and then I relied on meat because I wasn't eating any wheats. So I had a pretty plant-based and meat-based diet, and not to sound like a commercial, but when I did give up meat again, I actually felt like I had so much more energy and didn't ever think that I would feel as good as I did. And so, I don't know, in terms of our own diets, I think there's a lot to be said in my personal experience from relying on plant-based proteins instead of meat-based proteins. It's just made me feel so much better.
Great. Okay. these questions are really all over the place, and I'm trying to group them into categories here. But I wanted to just make one comment. The first one that popped up here, and I would encourage everyone to use the app. I'm sorry about that. I wish I could help you, but I'm up here right now. Anyway, one comment that came in, this is of local interest. This is the first comment that popped up here, the first question. It's actually a comment. Could you please share that Boulder County is looking for homeowners who are willing to offer a 10 by 20 area of lawn to support research in carbon farming in our soil? This brings up the question, how do we all become active participants? How do we do something? And I think we can talk about diet. We can talk about, you know, how do we consume? How do we buy things? Our choices that we make are incredibly important on an individual basis. Some years ago, I was reading a book by Daniel Miller, who's a sociologist. A sociologist said that the consumer is the dictator of the world because our decisions, which talk about how things are produced in other countries, the desire, the demand, and maybe we could have a few comments on that sort of side of it. What is the role of the consumer, and how can we become more activist if we really want to see change, if we're concerned about change?
Experiential ed and the travel industry, they just go hand in hand. So it's that old John Dewey philosophy that, you know, you can't have banking education where you deposit information, withdraw it. You have to use the senses. You have to see, smell, taste, touch. And travel affords that opportunity. But Dewey also believed that it wasn't real learning unless it included some interpretation. That was the role of the instructor. I think in travel it's the role of the guide to facilitate a deeper understanding. And in that context, I do believe that travel can be a very positive influence to understanding change. It can be a fantastic influencer in terms of understanding inequity. It can certainly introduce topics of concern around climate and climate change from a local perspective. If you're in Latin America, you feel it. If you're in Africa, you feel it. And what are those perspectives? We've actually conducted a training with our staff in Africa in particular to educate them on how to talk about this topic, because they were always being asked questions, and there was language that they weren't familiar with because it's not in the vernacular, it's not in the press of Africa as much. And so we had to talk about climate change. We had to talk about what their issues were. We had to talk about helping them come to grips with what the impacts are in terms of their family histories of farming or their family history with cattle. Because there were a lot of aggressive questions to our Maasai guides, for instance, about cattle. Sometimes we don't figure out how to express ourselves so politely. Starting with sending, you know, reference to shithole countries. Excuse my bias. So we've had those kinds of conversations because we want to make sure that that's a part and parcel of the guest experience, is to hear local perspective on those views. And so we consciously guided some introspection about what those answers might be.
So I think absolutely we have power as consumers, and I would say that there are four probably major ways that we could interject our coalition building into those pillars of power or places, and one is corporations, one is religions, another is institutions, and finally government. So I feel like if we're not working in all of those places simultaneously, then it won't really work. And I think that if we don't have money, we have multitudes. So we have coalitions of people that often are working towards the same goals for different reasons, and we need to get those coalitions together and to speak with each other and also with those four major pillars of power.
There's a few students in the audience, and I want to get to their questions, especially because they are inheriting the future that we are creating for them. How can caring, empathy, be awakened and impact the hearts of all ages? How can we expand our circle of caring and motivate effective, benevolent action? Deep, but important.
I mean, to me, there's only one way, and that's by talking to people. And that's by talking to people who aren't from your circles, who aren't part of your communities. I mean, there's no possible way we can really figure out how people feel or their experiences without talking to them. So I think it's a very tricky one. But I'm confident that we can do so with sharing people's stories. I think it's generally the only way we can do it, unless we're in somebody else's shoes.
I kind of shared earlier that one of the nicest phone calls to get is from the mother or father of a family that's just traveled with us, because kids get it. And philanthropy, you made reference, philanthropy is a learned activity. And so we open the door to that type of learning. When kids are, you know, overseas and they're seeing the inequity, then you have to get them that chance to go past looking out the window of a luxury safari vehicle at poverty and give them a chance for the interaction. So we stage this consciously, give them the exposure to a school, give them exposure to a medical clinic. We talk about the medical delivery challenges, the educational delivery challenges, job creation challenges. And when a child's heart is opened in that experiential way, giving them an outlet to then make a difference. The nicest calls are when, you know, the kids go back and they're working with their youth group, or they're working with their church group, or they're working with the Girl Guides, and wanting to establish something that they want to own. That's a lifetime skill that we're trying to introduce.
Yeah, I think empathy happens in public spaces. I'm thinking about like driving a car and how easy it is to get road rage and get mad at a person who you can't immediately talk with, and then how much empathy you have when you're talking with someone in space face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So sharing stories, maybe not necessarily always over the internet or on Facebook or whatever social media you use, but really in public space, I think makes a big difference.
Okay, this is a something of a follow-up question, but I think it goes in a little more detail. As a student, it's frustrating to see adults waiting for those in power to make big changes instead of making changes in their own life. How do you suggest young people get adults to care enough to make changes in their own life?
Boom. Yeah, that one gets
good. Who asked that question?
Can't we get a beer to talk about this?
So the question was, how do we get adults to care about? Yeah.
I think there's a level of comfort that people want, right? And so changing that desire for that level of comfort is probably the first thing I would suggest. It's like maybe that level of maybe those things that you thought you needed for that comfort aren't really necessary, or for that love aren't really necessary. So maybe it's, again, I think it goes back to desire, at least in part.
I think maybe you can't get your parents or someone to care, but you can. I know you might be a kid, but I mean, clearly you're pretty clever if you pitched us that question. But I mean, you can as a kid get involved in a lot of causes. I mean, you can support. I mean, there's a million things you can do as a kid. The same things you can do as an adult, you know. I think it's, yeah, try to seek out a community that shares your concerns. I think, just get involved. You might not be able to convince someone specifically, but there's always going to be people out there who share your concerns and ways to sort of mobilize a group to, yeah, make the change.
Yeah, I feel like it always feels good to think you change someone's heart or mind, but I think maybe energy better spent often is finding like-minded people and just going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, this question hits on some points that I think came up and were addressed earlier. As a psychologist, I see cognitive distortions impacting individuals and families. Now I see disinformation and thinking errors and falsehoods being accepted as truth by almost half of our American population. How do we best combat this anti-science, anti-truth trend?
Oh.
I feel like these questions are all very similar. And I don't know, for me, there's no intellectual answer you can really give except to talk to someone who is not of the same, who doesn't come from the same background as you. Maybe they don't have the same political inclinations as you. But I feel like, yeah, if someone's willing to deny facts and they just want to believe what they want to believe, I mean, you can try. And I mean, you can talk with them face to face, as we said, not online. I feel like that is the only way. And try not to get angry. That's what I would really suggest. I think it's very easy to get very frustrated when someone's coming from a place that you think is just insane. But at least from my experience, if you can try to be empathetic, try to take the high road, and yeah, have a conversation with them. That's, again, as I said, it's not an intellectual answer, but I feel like it's the only answer you can really give to something like that, particularly when facts fail. So,
how do you do that with a family member?
I mean, I get it. It's really hard. Like, we've all sat around the dinner table and had that awkward moment in our lives when we realize our values are very different to our parents, maybe our kids, our siblings, or something like that. Yeah, it's tricky, but they're your family after all, so you should be able to be honest.
Okay, here's... we'll shift a little bit. Where did this get to? We have a few questions about travel, and this one I think kind of is something of a summary. Travel has immeasurable value for education. It also heavily impacts the environment. Panelist insight to this dichotomy.
So we get this a lot, and it's an important topic because there's a carbon footprint to travel, and that's the one that comes up most often, especially in Boulder. And it's a real issue.
Yikes.
Our ability around the world to move ourselves, move large volumes of people, has increased exponentially. We can fly longer, we can fly faster. We've got all sorts of off-road ATV vehicles to get people to places that were previously inaccessible except by foot and struggle. And these systems are facilitating a larger number of folks. And we've had countries that previously didn't allow their population to travel. Now they're coming in very significant numbers. Obviously China, but that's one of many. These influences are not going to go away. The industry itself is the largest industry in the world when you include all the backward linkages. And so the question becomes not one of, do we stop it, or do we preclude it in some way, or inhibit it? But rather to figure out, are there ways that we can do things better? And there's an organization that started here in Boulder called Sustainable Travel International, which is one of many that have been focused on issues of environmental footprint, energy, water, solid waste management, landscaping, procurement, and taking a look at the operation of parts of the travel paradigm, the travel pipeline, has been really important. And it's gone past, the signs in the hotels about, reuse your towels. That's where things start. There's always a starting point. Now, many of these hotels are actually embracing, much, much deeper issues around energy, issues around water consumption, and the systems that are delivering those. There's been a desire on the part of urban properties to be able to say, hey, we're doing our best for sustainability as well. Great. Let's give them the certification. Let's give them recognition. There's also been a migration to recognizing, in the context of travel and sustainability, that the host communities need to be beneficiaries. That's kind of what I speak to most often. And so we've embraced that as a principle of our operation, and many companies have done the same. I don't want to highlight us too much because it's a trend in the industry that they are doing what they can to help with educational and benefits going to host communities. But here's an individual. Here's the challenge. There's another organization called the International Ecotourism Society that had a very strong campaign. It's a great message. Your travel choice can make a difference. And it can. How you choose your operator, how you choose those hotels, and consciously asking, what are your investments in your environmental footprint? And what are your investments in the host communities? Ask your tour operator, what are they doing that makes a real difference? So I'm going to get a slight bit provocative because sometimes it makes it more interesting. There's an organization called Pack for a Purpose, and I won't ask anyone to raise their hands because a lot of you may know of them. But it kind of disgusts me that we're still advocating for guests before they leave to take a little bit of space in their suitcases, run down to Walmart, buy a whole bunch of Chinese plastic crap, carry it across, and then randomly distribute it. That image of the Western visitor, usually white, handing something to someone on the ground who's going to be so appreciative, gag me. If that's the standard, you know, of which we're going to talk about giving back, handing out sweeties or notebooks or plastic shoes or this nonsense, stuff, carrying more stuff around the globe never changed a life or a livelihood. So we've tried to, you know, facilitate a dialogue relative to travel that says, no, if we're going to do something, it's got to tangibly improve access to healthcare, access to water, access to a job. And so asking your tour operator, what are you doing, and listen to the answer. You know, if they're still carrying books, carbon, you know, around, that's not making a difference. I can't stand going into a library in a rural African school, and you can literally, you know, all these donated books, the geology of Utah. This stuff still happens. So there's ways to make a difference as an individual traveler, but primarily as a consumer, asking your supplier these types of questions.
I wanted to follow a little about that on travel. In your experience, how educated is the typical eco-tourist on the place that they're going, the culture, and the issues that those folks are facing?
I think most people try to do a little reading ahead of time. Sometimes, you know, that happens on the plane as they're going to the place. And sometimes folks are very knowledgeable, but probably most have chosen the destination because they're interested in learning more. And, you know, you want to facilitate as much depth of understanding and learning as possible. And I think your comments about conversation, authentic conversations, real dialogue, you have to facilitate those on the ground. And those are real introductions with folks from the region. And so that should be scheduled as part of the time and the activities, the things that you're going to be doing. I loved your language around, you know, dialogue and conversation building empathy and understanding.
Yeah, and there's a few questions that are centered on each one of our panelists. There's a couple here for Leslie. I'll try to summarize them together. Leslie, please talk about how Index inspires designers worldwide to create products and processes that improve life versus products that end up in landfills. And if you could give us some examples.
Okay, so the organization I work for is we've existed since 2002. So basically, we're all about promoting and mobilizing any kind of design and innovation that solves problems, you know, or at least attempts to, something similar to climate change, for example. So, of course, the award is a big part of that. And that's, you know, for example, in 2019, we received 1,800 submissions. So these are all designs from all over the world that are basically in the service of doing good. So the award, of course, is an inspiration beacon. Well, we hope it is. We hope it, contrary to the media a lot, provides hope that we provide solutions as opposed to just problems. And I think that's incredibly important. And of course, by celebrating the best of these solutions, it inspires a whole bunch of other innovation. I think in the past, what is incredible is seeing, I mean, we talked about Life Straw before, so that's actually one of our winners from 2005. But what is most exciting to us is seeing a solution that was sort of highlighted maybe 10 years ago, and then seeing how it has developed and changed and really broadened impact. You know, people have taken this technology, they've improved it, and they've, as I said, they've broadened the impact. Just to clarify, what was the question about?
Okay, one second.
Was this about processes and...
How Index inspires designers worldwide to create products and processes that improve life versus products that end up in landfills?
I mean, I think the closing loop is absolutely fundamental. So, for example, when we vet a design, we vet it on three sustainability aspects. And that's not just about environmental, that's about economic, and that's about social as well. So I think, as I said, by sort of elevating the best and making sure these solutions get invested in, I believe that has really driven at least sustainable innovation. And I mean, from 2005 to 2019, it's only grown, and as I said, it's really exciting to see. So of course there's huge developments, but of course, yeah, it's not just about celebrating, it's about investing in these investments and in these innovations, and of course it's about education. So we need to get our kids involved as young as possible. I think another key part of the work we do at Index is pretty much going into schools and pitching these problems to kids and saying, you know, what kind of solution can you come up with? And that has worked tremendously for us. And what we found is, you don't have to, I've talked about this before in some other panels, but you don't have to sugarcoat things for kids. You know, you'd be surprised about how much they can handle and what kind of ideas they can come up with. So in summary, I'd say there's three ways to do it. Yeah, it's teaching kids, it's, you know, celebrating the best kinds of innovations, and then of course it's the capital, it's the investment into these innovations. And that's what I truly believe. If we're going to make any dent in, you know, this climate catastrophe, it pretty much, of course it comes down to us as consumers and changing our behavior, but then the other half of it is coming up with solutions where things can't be changed. I mean, something like transport, that's fundamental. So how can we make that greener? How can we offset all of those impacts? I hope that answered the question.
Sure. Any other comments to that? I'll summarize a number of other questions. And how do we deal with greenwashing? And is that a huge problem? Because people look at something and they think they're making a right decision, but there's a lot of misinformation on packaging and actually what these words mean. What does all natural mean? Very little, right? Oil is all natural, right? Uranium is all natural. I wouldn't eat that. So how do we combat this sort of, is this something we need to, is it regulation, or is there some other measures that can we inform our population? Should we do these in the schools? Should we educate people better? You know, one thing I'm always pushing for, should we have a sustainability certificate mandatory for most institutions of higher learning? If this is the future, where is our, you know, our educational system being involved in this? I know that's a loaded question, but, you know, it all goes back to what information do we have to make informed decisions?
I mean, I think it takes a combination of everything you talked about. I mean, education is one thing, but I definitely believe we should have a global standard of certification. Yeah, greenwashing, it's a huge problem, but yeah, certification, I would think, would be the best way to go about it.
What is it?
Greenwashing, so it's basically when a company uses language or any kind of branding or anything like that to imply that they are sustainable, basically, in summary. So often, yeah, a lot of companies will, you know, it's all pretty much about the brand, but they're actually not doing anything that is sustainable or ecological or anything like that.
Yeah, it's basically lying about the benefits or lack of impact of a product has on the environment or you as a human being or your own body.
So you've got a travel industry guy on the panel. So I think my best contribution is to speak from the industry perspective. This is a serious topic. There are so many firms that just overstate, overrepresent. You know, if they travel to China and they gave a $1,000 contribution for panda research, they probably are not saving the panda. You know, they're one of 4,000 companies that are supporting it, most at far more significant levels. And there is a plethora of example of companies in this industry that will overstate and overbroadcast. They might do something really worthwhile. They might spend a few dollars or carry a few guests to a site, but then they're going to spend five times that amount doing an advertorial about all the good they're doing. I kind of hate that. And honestly, one of the nice ways to get past some greenwash, I thought Yvon Chouinard started a put up there. It's not a certification exactly, but he went to his supply line and said 1%. 1% of what you make needs to go back to sustaining this place we call Earth. And so 1% for the planet launched. And companies that participate actually have to have that vet in order to get that 1% certification. In the idea of 1% in the travel industry, very rare. Very few companies can even represent that they're giving 1%. Even if they're living and operating and succeeding and making money from some of the most beautiful natural and cultural heritage sites in the world, there's not the demand for them to give back. We're seeing the influence of CSR and sort of corporate philanthropy, and it is changing. I want to believe that there's a greater desire to do good. There's a greater desire to do honest good with integrity. But greenwash, wow. Still rampant.
I want to share a story that I'm apprehensive about telling. And I mean, I think it happens a lot in art in the United States where a company offers money to support an artwork. And I don't want to sound Pollyanna, but so Swale is a floating food forest on a barge, and people can come onto Swale and pick fresh food for free. It's combating this 100-year-old law in New York City that doesn't allow anything to be picked from public space, and it goes to places where there are food deserts. So you can circumvent that land law by going onto this barge. And the barge has spurred other things to happen, so it's now there is a site where you can pick fresh food for free in a park, and it might start more, so there could be this momentum that builds from it. But there have been lots of contradictory times for Swale. So I think, you know, its first year it was supported by a grant from an arts organization called A Blade of Grass and a Kickstarter campaign, and we had enough money to pay for the barge rental for that year. And so I thought it would all be taken down. In the second year, Strongbow, a cider company, approached us about doing a sponsorship, and I thought, well, the project is going to end if we don't do this sponsorship. It was going to support us for another year. And their case was convincing. And so they said, well, we spend $100,000 on doing a commercial. If we could do this commercial on the barge, and we would also give you apple trees, we would give you that money instead. And we said, that sounds like a great idea. Would you also do this in turn? And I think we felt like we had some power sitting at the table with a corporation that we could potentially influence. They were absolutely influencing us. It's happened in several cases to people I know where Pepsi has sponsored a mural, actually for a student of mine, a mural that sort of is about water. And she thought, well, at least I can be at the table with Pepsi to have these conversations and maybe they'll change. So it's an ethically ambiguous place to be, and I'm curious about maybe people's reactions to that. Or, you know, I think in the United States, where there isn't much funding for the arts, artists are looking for ways to do large projects, and it's often contradictory.
Okay. I hear you.
Thanks.
This is a question. I'm trying to find a way to rephrase this without putting too much of my own influence on it. So I guess I'll just read it. Isn't sustainability an issue for the wealthy? And I would like to add something there that obviously us in the Western world, particularly in the United States, consume almost five planets worth of our what's there versus the developing world, maybe half a planet worth. I mean, half a planet more than what we have. So, you know, we're consuming at a rate nearly five times what we can replenish this planet. So where does the responsibility lie in the developed world, particularly in this country, because we are the worst of the worst in terms of the amount of waste and we produce and what we consume. So what is our responsibility and developed countries' greater responsibility towards solving this problem?
Just looking at me.
Is there an innovation angle to it?
Sir?
Is there an innovation angle?
Yeah, I think we have responsibility and in wealthy countries and our lives and in our careers. I don't think that we should separate what we do in our career from what we do in our life. And I guess that's the simple answer. Mm-hmm. Go for it.
I mean, absolutely, we have a role to play, and particularly because we are so privileged, we have choices. We have choices we can make. So, I mean, a really simple way to do it is just less. Less, less, less. Less of everything. Less travel, less meat, less buying. I mean, if you have to buy, you know, support brands that are at least doing something to try to change it. I know it's difficult. I mean, if you have to buy fashion, buy vintage. Yeah, and boycott brands that aren't doing anything to solve the problem. It's tricky and it's complex, but we can always try it. And I mean, we can always do better. So of course we have a responsibility, and of course there's everything we can do. I think also for older members in the audience, you have a responsibility. If this is the way you feel, it would be great to mentor younger kids. I mean, I think it's really refreshing, particularly with the question we had in the audience before, how can I convince my parents or my grandparents that they should something, you know, this is something they should care about. So mentorship, I think, is also a great way to do it. And I think, you know, even being online, don't just like things, I think share things. If you come across information that is really helpful, useful, and you think, well, hopefully factual, yeah, share it. I think that's incredibly important. I think there's a million things we can do just as regular people.
Absolutely. I'm going to chime into the chorus, but I'm remembering a gentleman named Stanley Selengut, who's from the East Coast. He talks with a New York accent, Stanley. And he owned a resort in the Caribbean, on St. John's, Maho. And he had a beautiful philosophy that when he hosted his guests, he said, you know, they're coming with all that New York stuff. And I get one week of their precious vacation time. And it's the one week when their minds might be open to influence and might be open to new ideas. And so he began to educate them about what they were eating. And then he began to install submeters so he could tell them how much water they used and how much hot water and what the source of the heating for the hot water was. And he said he found no greater joy than in listening to a couple of New York lawyers argue about who used the least amount of water that morning. And then he went to an art show and they were blowing glass. And he thought, that's so great, they're blowing recycled glass. And so he invited these artists down. He gave them some free rooming, and then he taught the Rastas on the island how to blow glass, and they would make these beautiful little memorabilities about the sea turtles and things that they would like to purchase to carry back. And then he said it was just a wonderful thing that he was giving his, you know, the heavy glass that he was using at the bar and in the kitchen to the Rastas to blow glass that the guests were then buying and carrying away for him. And he would wave, goodbye, thank you for taking my garbage, and you paid me for it. So, yes, there's lots that we need to do, but we can be creative in our solutions as well.
Thank you. There's a number of questions that I don't think we are maybe able to answer, such as how do we clean up all the plastic from the ocean, or are composting toilets good or bad? You know, these are all powerful questions, and I don't know if you'd like to handle them. I don't want to ignore them. I think it's maybe above, you know, not our pay grade, but our career grade. I just wanted to acknowledge some of those, because I think these are issues that we all need to be made aware of. But I just want to finish up. The second part of that question was, what would you consider are two of the most important things we could do personally? And then there's another question here that's asking us to come up with 15 things that audience can do to slow climate change. So, I mean, we talked about meat, we talked about other things. That stop driving cars. The solutions are complicated. So how do we take some of these most complicated things and work with them?
like that maybe they're not two, they're not 15, but maybe they're 1,000 that sort of reflect off of each other. But just get your feedback on either of these two points that were brought up.
I mean, actually, I was interested to answer the question about the plastic in the oceans.
Oh,
if I can.
Please do.
I think, coming from my experience, we've seen a lot of incredible solutions that want to solve this problem. I don't know if anyone's seen the ocean cleanup system. It's come under a lot of heat in the media. So it's basically this young Dutch gentleman. So when he was 16, he came up with this concept that basically acts like a big filter that's safe for wildlife, don't worry, that you can put it into basically the ocean currents, and as the ocean flows, then it can collect the plastic. They built it in San Francisco Bay, I think almost 2 years ago, and they've had it tested once in the Great, I think it's the North Pacific Garbage Patch. That's one solution. I think another solution is, of course, reducing plastic, and that's something as consumers we can do, and even we can get, I'm sure maybe some of you have seen these microplastic filters you can get for your washing machine. You can buy those. So it's really essential that if you can get your hands on one of those, you should get one of those. We get a lot of microplastics coming out from the clothing when we wash it. I think the third approach is coming up with the different kinds of bioplastics. So, I mean, we've seen some great solutions developed from algae, cassava plants. There's a million things we can do, but I would say there's a three-pronged approach to that. So it's bioplastics, using less plastic, and then I have every confidence in the world that we will have these large-scale solutions that will help get this plastic out of the ocean. But let's see how many decades it takes. But, let's see.
Okay. Here's a question. I think I'll do my best to paraphrase. I'll just read it. The recent book, Losing Earth, exposes how oil companies use propaganda to change politics and make science a political issue. How do we get the oil companies that now acknowledge human-caused climate change to undo what they've done? Or, I think we're all somewhat responsible for that. But I'd like to get your opinions on that one.
Take it away, guys.
I know. Nobody said it was going to be easy.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, maybe look at it another way. If we have this powerful monetary political machine, I think the question is also asking, what measures we can take as individuals to put pressure on that system. We can, of course, vote. And there's a question here about how do we get younger people to vote more, since it's their future. And I'd like to sort of blend that in here. But how can, if this is the big problem, the problem is that political, there's another question here about how can we make political change. Obviously we do that at the ballot box, but we don't always have the best choices either. So what does the individual do in terms of engaging a political conversation at a local level and have that become a much larger voice if it starts to resonate through many communities throughout the country and world?
Well, I think the divestment movement is really important, and that happens on a local level. And then also using less is essential, and talking with your religious leaders is another form of pressure. Doing all those things at the same time, I think, are the only way to really change things, and not one person doing them, but everyone.
In working with new destinations, one of the things that you sort of carry with you as an a priori, just a real first step, is to try to gather the elders of that particular destination. And so in many, many locations, we would gather the 10 or 15 oldest members of a community and ask, well, what is special about your place? What is the power of this place? When a guest visits, what do you want them to to take away? What do you want them to remember, learn about your place? How should we represent your place? And in the context of those conversations, almost every time, in local language, there would be some expression of sustainability and stewardship. And they would reflect upon their role and what they remember as kids and the diversity that they may have experienced if they were particularly in you know, living with side by side with wildlife. In Namibia, a lot of those conversations helped to establish the principles of the conservancy program that's in the country. I was recently challenged by some elders and asked, have you ever held this type of a conversation with your elders? You know, I never went to the nursing home and had the conversation. I did ask my mom, my kid's grandma, to invite some of her friends because I wanted them to hear a certain background on topics. And you know, I think extending the dialogue and opportunity for dialogue to those folks that historically traditional communities would respect with elder rights. Maybe we need the wisdom of our elders. We don't tend to look that way, but certainly I was challenged to do it, and it was very rewarding.
Yeah, I on stewardship and then back to responsibility, I think something that I found through living in New York is that so much of the potential responsibility we could have is taken away, and it's always someone else's responsibility. And so we can put our, you know, we see the amount of garbage that we make, it's on the street, but we can always put whatever we want in the garbage and it's taken away. I think that like instilling more responsibility is something that is exciting for a lot of people. I think going on to Swale, I learned that because people would come and suddenly be surprised that they could pick anything and then all of a sudden want to take care of that space because other people were picking from it. And I think that in such a litigious space where we can't really do anything in our parks or not much at all, we're not given that responsibility. So I think trying to give the responsibility back to us is the first step.
Okay, we have just a few minutes left. I don't know if I'll get to another question, but it keeps coming up. What are the things we can do? What is our way to become more powerful? Or to, you know, I think we're doing this, or we're talking about this. Just a brief anecdote, and then We'd like to have an anecdote, and then we'll get some concluding statements from the panel. One thing I tell my students: look at the labels on your clothing. Where does stuff come from, and who are the people that are making them? What's the living condition they're in? What are they getting paid? And just compare your lifestyle to theirs. And I think that's the first thing that kind of shocks them sometimes. If I ask them to actually do research on that, they realize that their impact is really global. And I think almost we have to start thinking that way, no matter where we are in the world, especially in the developed world. So that's going to be my comment here. And I'd like maybe the panel to finish up with some ideas that they have or thoughts they have.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think that it is easy for us to rationalize and compromise. We are creative beings, and I think creativity is full of contradiction, but it can't shut us down, and we can't hold it against people, and I think we just need to move forward.
Fall back on that earlier expression that your travel choice makes a difference, your consumer choice makes a difference. I wanted to share just one little success up in Jackson Hole. There was some dead space, and it was on literally the side of a parking garage, and 1% companies contributed the early seed money, and they built a vertical greenhouse. It's 4 stories high, and it's only about 16 feet wide, but it circulates, and in an area of very difficult to grow greens in the winter and most of the year. It's a source. It's a source of greens. But they employ folks with disabilities, and because it's so close to the main square, it's actually one of the most visited sites in the town of Jackson today. And there are so many great examples like that in our communities, and Boulder's got more than most, sort of visiting, supporting, looking for opportunity to replicate. I think they're out there. There are sources of inspiration in all of our communities worthy of our visit, worthy of our learning and communicating more about.
I guess just following on what Matthew was saying about knowing where your product come from, I think that's incredibly important. Of course, buying local is one thing we can all do. But I think we've seen some really interesting developments, particularly in relation to that, where we're seeing a lot of services pop up where they can basically use blockchain to help track the life cycle of your products. One example is called a service called Provenance, based out of the UK, and I urge you all to check that out. But as I said earlier, less is the key.
Okay, thank you. It looks as if we are out of time. I'd like to thank everybody for coming out and all your wonderful questions. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of them. There's only so much time in this session. Thank you so much.